Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. Day Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host, and this is MJ Network. MJ, in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who started me on this road. So, we've got five of the greatest authors in the whole universe on this show today, and I'm going to introduce them in just a moment. We've got one of my favorite people in the world. She's got hot and steamy, Victoria Templeton, the host of A Good Story is a Good Story. Marcia Casper Cook is here. Hi.
Hi. Hello. How are you?
And we've got, hanging in there, John Land, who's the author of two of my favorite series, Murder, She Wrote, with my favorite Jessica Fletcher, and the other person that reminds me of me, Caitlin Strong series. And yeah, your book is in my Read It This Week pile. And we've got John Land. Hi. Good morning, everybody. And
Hi,
we've got Alan Topol, and he promised never to kill off his main characters ever, ever, ever. And we have the Craig Page series. And we've got Marilyn Levitt. Hi, this is so cool. We've got Marilyn Levinson, and she can't kill off Laura, and she has to keep the ghost in her books, otherwise I'll be sad. And we've got R.G. Belsky, and I just finished Below the Fold, and let me tell you, Claire Carlson is really, she's so like me, it's scary. She goes after it. Good morning, everybody.
Hi.
Good morning, Fran.
Hi, everybody.
And everyone.
Hi, hello. Hello, everybody.
Hi, everybody, before it snows.
Oh, wait,
so,
Fran, before I forget, I forget, I'll help you turn that music softer.
Oh, thank you. Later. Thank
okay.
you. We'll do that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right, I'll help you later. Did everybody think it was loud, the music?
Yes.
Was it loud?
Yes.
I thought, okay.
That's because I want to make sure.
I'll help you with that because, yeah, it's really, you probably don't realize that we're hearing it really loud.
I don't hear anything today, no.
Okay, well,
dialogue can either drive a plot forward or it can make you fall asleep. Dialogue should add to the plot by adding the reader to understand the character's personality, possibly having an accent to allow readers to know where the character or characters originate. But some authors write in the first person, some use limited dialogue, and some use third or second person, and some have, well, they need help, like me. So the first question is, how do you create your dialogue from the start of the novel? Do you use a description of the physical appearance of the character or characters or the setting, or do you get the action going? And, John, why don't you start us off?
First off, I think dialogue is the blood of a story. It's what flows. It's what makes people, mm-hmm. what warms everything up, what brings mm-hmm. the story to life. So many people, when they talk about thrillers, they often admit that they skip long passages of description, as in the old Tom Clancy novels, and they get to the dialogue.
Yeah.
So I have a rule. I wouldn't call it quite a hard and fast rule, but if you look at the chapters of my, especially my Caitlin Strong books, I'd say about mm-hmm. half of them, if not more, open with a line of dialogue. Because nothing is more important or nothing is more effective in drawing the reader in than hearing a character speak.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's really a matter of, to your question about description and everything else, or dialogue to be effective needs to be organic. It needs to not be written by the writer. It needs to come from the character. They need to dictate what we type. And if we start writing dialogue from our characters instead of listening to what our characters are saying to us, saying to the reader, then the book is going to come off as our story instead of our character story. So for me, it's organic, but there is no better way to move a story forward to keep the reader's attention than to incorporate dialogue into the story. And when you're able to do that, when as a writer you can move your story forward not based on what you're saying or telling, but based on what characters are saying to each other, then you've figured out how to tell a story.
This is Archie Belsky here, and I just wanted to point out that this is basically, I think, the same lineup almost, or pretty close to it, that we had a few months ago when we were on this show, and that was a pretty good show. So hopefully, and I realized as John was talking that my first comment was going to be the same thing I said on the last show, which is I pretty much agree with everything John just said, because I had written down a few notes of things, and you know, unfortunately, John, you like hit a lot of my high points. But look, I especially the part about skipping over long passages to get to the dialogue, because I'm guilty of that too. Look, I love dialogue. I love to write the dialogue. I love reading dialogue in a book, and I think the two are intertwined, because I tend to write about the kinds of things I like. Some of my favorite books, the one that comes to mind is Spencer, Robert Parker's Spencer series, which did pretty well, 50 books, and still going strong with Ace Atkins. And that sells on the dialogue. It's the back and forth between Spencer and Susan and Hawk and the bad guy. There's very little description, when I read Jack Reacher, I love the action scenes, but there's not like a lot of I don't need a lot of description. It's the dialogue. It's the back and forth. So to me, writing dialogue is maybe the most important thing an author could do in a book, and because it brings out the other most important thing, which is the character. To me, there's nothing more important, even the story, than the character. You gotta like the character, and the dialogue sells the character.
I agree.
I agree too.
I just want to say that there's a noise coming through. I don't know what it is, but
it's really
disturbing.
Yeah, I can hear it too.
It might be somebody breathing. It's somebody breathing on the phone.
Please be careful. Yeah. Well, I wanted to say that I often start with dialogue. Simply, I feel the dialogue. I don't either. But the dialogue, I feel, reflects and teaches and shows the personality of the character speaking. It shows the relationship between this person and whomever he's speaking with, or her, or people, and it furthers the plot. And frankly, as you just said, all of you, it entertains, and that's really what we like to have in a book.
Hi, it's Marcia. I agree. I agree, too. I agree totally. I mean, I told Fran before when we were talking, before the show, I said I think we probably all agree it's the most important thing, and our characters talk. If my characters don't talk to me, then I know that they're not real. They talk
and also
to me.
This is Alan Topol. One of the things, and I, sir, listening to John Land refreshed me a very long time ago. I was reading some F. Scott Fitzgerald notes on one of his novels, and I remember, because it stuck with me for God knows how many years ago, he wrote, dialogue is action, and that's kind of what, paraphrasing what John Land said, but it's very, very true. It always stuck with me, is that dialogue is a great way to advance your story beyond everything else, beyond the characters, and just... You really got to think that in mind and view dialogue as action, because that's what it is. And and that's kind of what you were saying, John Land, I think. I think Fitzgerald was paraphrasing you on that, probably.
Well, since you bring up F. Scott Fitzgerald, I'm going
to
throw out... I was going to throw out Ernest Hemingway because you threw out F. Scott Fitzgerald, and
sure.
One of the things I always love, I love with you know, when I've read stuff about Hemingway is when he writing about dialogue, and you know, I guess this is pretty well known, but you know, he wrote all his you know, obviously long before computers, he wrote all the beautiful description stuff out in longhand. He wrote it, you know, with a pen and paper or whatever. He wrote all his dialogue on a typewriter. He stood at a typewriter, he wrote the dialogue. And the explanation was you to get the feel of dialogue, you got to have that rat-a-tat-tat on a typewriter that you can't get with the other thing. And I always found that really interesting because it kind of captures the feel I think you want to get when you're writing dialogue, which is quick, fast, and, you know, to
the
point.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing
which
that I find...
Which my next question. Actually, that was the next question I was going to ask. How's about that? John, you do this. Alan, you do this. And RG does this. And everybody else does this. I can't do this. I write from the point of view of a dead person that doesn't speak. I speak for that person. They don't say a word. I just tell their story. And I just rewrote it because somebody read it and told me how to fix it, sort of. I hope it's okay. But when you write, I could feel Caitlin getting mad. I could feel Claire Carlson in the last book. She didn't stop until she got what she wanted. How do you figure that when you're the dialogue, I feel the emotion in every one of your books. How do you do that? I mean, I'm reading it. I'm saying, like, Caitlin's going to smack somebody in the head. Claire's going to step over somebody in the newsroom if they dare to mess with her. Craig Page, Elizabeth is really strong. Victoria Templeton holds no bars, and Laura, too, but I like the ghost. Sorry, I love the ghost. So how do you get that emotion across, and are the sentences short and crisp, you know, the dialogue? Because, like I said, I just write from the point of view of the dead person speaking, and that's how I do it. So how do you get that across? Because I can feel it when you're writing.
But, Fran, you could probably do it with your dead people, I think, because you could have your dead people talking to somebody, remembering a conversation that they had.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I did that. But I don't have any quotes. I just let them talk, and then I rewrote it because somebody said if I did backstories about my characters, that would help, so I did. So hopefully it'll be better now that it's being re-edited for the 97th time. But how do you guys do it? Because I have no clue.
Well, Fran, let me that's Alan. Let me give you one thought. I always worried when I started writing that my dialogue should be authentic, the way people really talk. And I don't know, an editor told me, I think an old-time editor, Howard Cady maybe, but what I did is I become great at eavesdropping. When I'm sitting on the metro in Washington, or when I'm sitting in a restaurant or anywhere, I'm always trying to find myself listening in on what other people are saying at the next table, in the next subway, because I want to hear how they talk. Real.
Right.
I want my dialogue to be realistic, and so I listen to people. It's terrible, I admit. I'm a confirmed eavesdropper, really.
Well, I think one thing is, this is Marilyn, that we do not always, in dialogue, any of us, and our characters especially, they do not always speak in sentences. They speak in phrases.
Right.
Yeah.
And we have
to
remember not to, I mean, you see this in beginning writers, they fill in the backstory in a very artificial way. You have to infer to that. You have to refer to it, but not build the whole thing in. And I think that you learn that with practice.
Yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're, you know, if you put, let's say you do an exercise on writing or whatever, you can put two people in a room and see what they talk about. It doesn't even have to be your characters. And they may start talking to each other, and then once the conversation starts, I think they just keep going on. But it is hard to do dialogue. I think in some people, it's not for me anymore, but it was when I started. And I think one of the things that I'm not telling people to write screenplays, but if you write a screenplay, you definitely know that you have to have a lot of dialogue. That's what it is. And so
that's what it depends on, yes.
Yeah, and I think that will help any writer out there if they do that, because I think that's a conversation that you have and go scene by scene. You know,
don't you think conflict is important, and that helps bring out the different feelings of the two people or three people speaking?
Yeah,
the conflict. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just like to follow up on what Alan said about listening to people, because I do it all the time, and I a lot of my books are drawn from a newsroom where there's people constantly talking and saying a lot of stuff. and like Alan, you know, like I'll listen. I'll write a lot in coffee shops or even on the subway or something.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm always listening to what people are saying. The one caveat I would say is you don't want to be too authentic, because you know, a lot of people, what they say in real life is boring, and so you kind of want to take that to get the real feeling. But you know, you want to get rid of all the uhs and the ohs. And,
yeah.
Oh yeah,
I
by
agree.
The way, you know,
and
it's like it's kind of like you take it, but you know, when people say, "Oh, I want it to be like real," it was real life. People are probably going to read your book, you know. So it's an interesting balance. But I basically I do just what Alan said, which is I try and pick up the feeling, and then I try and sell it a little better. I try and make their words better.
I think we make it seem real, not that it is real. Our job is to make it appear to be authentic.
Like you talk to a lot of people. Like Fran, you do talk to a lot of people all the time. Like my husband is always laughing because I'll go to the ladies' room, I'll go to the cashier wherever we are in a deli, whatever, and then I come back and he's saying, well, who are you talking to? I end up talking to someone, and I like that because that's how I learn about people. You know, I just different, and I want people that are different than me, not the same. That's one of the greatest things about doing a radio show is I've met so many people I never, ever would have met because they're from everywhere. It's not just my neighborhood or where I live in Chicago, you know. So I think if that's what, and Fran, you do talk to people. So just listen
not
to what
only
they're
do
saying.
I talk to
yes.
them. I get in trouble when somebody puts something on Facebook and says they have a new book, and I brilliantly say, when am I getting it? And then I get stuck with another one.
But if you want to write,
Goldberg puts, I know,
you have to give yourself time to write. But you have to give yourself
time. I will eventually. But Dick, when you add a news story, because I love Claire, Below the Fold, you guys got to read it. Oh, my God. This was really, the first one was good. This one's even over the top. Seriously?
Wow, thank you.
I really loved it. And what I really loved is that you honed in on the fact that there was a homeless person and that her voice needed to be heard, because that bothered me that the newsroom didn't care. And that's the title, Below
the
Fold.
Well, but that's the truth. That's real life.
I know. So when you're adding a news story or anybody adds a speech or something that somebody's writing, how do you add that in that it doesn't take away from the plot? Because lately I've been getting a lot of books and skipping over some of the words, and that's not good. And sometimes they have so much scenery that I go like, can you help me now? Here, not do that. So how do you add a news story or a speech to your writing and I don't skip over what you write? Ever.
Well, just to answer your question, since you raised the thing about basically the plot of the book is that a homeless woman is found dead, which is a nothing story in New York, and nobody cares. And it turns out, because my character begins looking into it, that it explodes into a massive story. I try the best I can not to preach in it. You know, I'm not trying to make a political stand at homeless or anything. I'm just trying to talk about the world kind of the way it is, certainly here in New York and in other places. But with Claire, I mean, in terms of using dialogue, I mean, there were a couple points where she says things which I thought got the point across. Like at one point she remembers seeing this woman on the street and kind of walking past her and, you know, like never really thinking about her. And then this other woman said, oh, I used to give her money for sandwiches or food. And Claire says something effective, you know, this woman who did that seems like a nice woman, and she's actually a nicer woman than me because I never did that. And so by doing that, I you know, that kind of dialogue with Claire saying it, I think I'm able to convey the fact that a lot of us feel, which is, gee, you know, we'd like to do more, but we never do. And then you feel a little guilty about it when tragedy happens.
I think it's when you bring in subjects that are part of the story that people pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a death, well, then in the book anyway, it's an issue.
Yeah.
So I think that's when you make it part of the plot. It's funny. I bring in the homeless situation in libraries in my book that's coming out in September, and you know that's part of the plot. But if you don't make it part of the plot, even the subplot, then I think it's ignored. But if you make it part of the plot, then the readers are interested.
Right, like if they do, if you know, on the TV shows, in a lot of the series now, because they have time, they add issues that they care about and maybe a few scenes, you know, and they do get their message across, you know,
mm-hmm.
because you're already in with the, you're, you know, involved in the story, and then you see what they do, and they could, you know, bring in somebody with a problem, and it people are apt to really listen and hone in on that, and it really wasn't a message, it was just a character they brought in, but it does have a, you know, he or she does have a message that they're giving in the series, you know.
Well, that's
for,
what I look for when I'm doing the review. I want to know what the author's trying to tell me.
Yeah.
And that's what people complain about, that I always get what they're trying to tell
me. Well, no, I think it's right about you.
Yes,
I think that's what I've said about you for all these years, because
it's scary.
Because a lot of people don't know how to write a summary. They don't know how to write a synopsis, a log line. But you actually get the story. But a lot of people don't get what writers are really trying to portray, which is sad sometimes. But you do. That's why people want you to review their books, because you understand what they've written.
I think
when we're talking about
dialogue, I think the key goes back to what someone said a few minutes back, and that is conflict. In the scene between two people talking, if they agree on everything, if they're just having a discussion, it's dull.
Boring.
It's boring.
Yeah.
It's not moving the story forward.
Right. Right.
And this is one of the issues that I confronted when I took over the Murder, She Wrote series. Because when you watch the TV series, almost every scene in the TV series has a definable conflict. It may be something that is a little more terse and pedantic, but it is a conflict. But the best scenes are the ones where Jessica is either outwardly confronting somebody. In the books, when I took over the series, I found the books flat. I'm being very honest here. Because of just what we're talking about. There was no sense of conflict within the dialogue that Jessica was having. She was having conversations with people that did not resolve anything. They just talked. But the other important thing, especially in third person, because I write my Caitlin Strong, my Texas Ranger Caitlin Strong thrillers in third person. I write my Jessica Fletcher books in first person. Someone mentioned, I think it might have been Alan, about Jack Reacher before, the Great Lee Child books.
Mm.
When I finish a Jack Reacher book, about half of them are first person and half of them are third person. I can never remember which it was. And that here comes a crucial point. Because when you're inside a character's head, when they are describing a scene for you, that character is speaking to you. It's indirect monologue. It's dialogue, but it's going directly from the hero or a character to the reader. So how you handle that indirect dialogue, how you handle what's going on in a character's head, thoughts are dialogue because they are being conveyed to the reader by without quotation marks. So it's just the same thing. There are just no quotation marks. So how you handle that? Now, in a first person, when you're writing first person, as I do with the Murder, She Wrote books, you have no choice because everything is I. So when you look at what I've done with Jessica, if she's not talking to somebody else, and here's the key point, she's talking to the reader because everything is I. The entire book, in other words, is dialogue. Now, it's more subtle when I write third person. But if you step back, you notice that every single scene is narrated from the viewpoint of a character, not from the omniscient narrator. Therefore, even though it's third person, you still have the same effect of the indirect dialogue that the character is addressing his or her thoughts to the reader.
But that's such a good thing because, you know, all of us are sitting here, listen, we're talking, but we know who Jessica Fletcher is. Do you know what I mean? And that is everybody wants that. So somebody have a character like that people remember forever. And she's one of them. you know, and that's because, maybe that's because of that, because it's written that way, we feel like we know her.
Mm-hmm. But we've also seen her on television.
Right, that's true. Well, right, and I'm very visual. I like that. You know, for me, I do.
Yeah. I see Angela Lansbury.
Right. So do I.
okay, but you know that's right. So people, they refer to her, I'm sure, when they see her as Jessica, because a lot of stars say that because they take on a role so well, you know, and yeah, and they become them for us.
Well, does that make it easier? I want this question for Jessica.
He made her different. He made her in the 21st century.
Which is good.
I like her much better now.
Well, this is a question for John, I guess, because you know, I've mentioned before. I know Reed Farrell Coleman, who's written a lot of the Jesse Stone, and you can't watch Jesse Stone without thinking of Tom Selleck. So, does that make it easier or harder to write, John, when people have an image of the character?
I actually think, you know, it's a great question. I think it makes it easier because what I do when I'm writing the Jessica Fletcher books is obviously I'm not doing it all the time. I write two a year. I write 96 other books. So when I'm doing the Jessica Fletcher books, I actually watch an episode of Murder, She Wrote before I start.
Really?
And that gets me in the mood. It gets me in the mindset.
Oh.
So yeah, it's a very interesting thing because I don't think when all the writers who have followed Ian Fleming are writing James Bond books, I don't think they're writing dialogue for Sean Connery. Maybe I would if I were writing the series, because to me he's the only Bond. But I don't know if there's ever been. It was just a great point made. If there's ever been a character as iconic and with 100% name recognition like Jessica Fletcher, who is totally owned by a single actor. When you think about it, how many actors have played Sherlock Holmes? How many actors have played James Bond?
Yeah.
How many actors have played Hercule Poirot?
Yeah.
Only one actress has ever played Jessica Fletcher.
Right.
And in fact, when they were going to reboot the series and Octavia Spencer was going to play Jessica, she pulled the plug because she said, I can't do this. There is only one Jessica Fletcher.
Right.
Nobody else. Now, I will get a little spoiler alert. I think I came up with a way. Past that a little bit. In not my next Jessica Fletcher book, which comes out in May, Murder in Red, but in the fall, A Time for Murder, you meet Jessica Fletcher in a flashback first-person thread. 25 years in the past, when she's still, when her husband Frank is still alive, they're raising their nephew Grady, she isn't a published writer yet, she's substitute teaching at Appleton, Maine. In other words, I'm reverse engineering the series. Under that scenario, if you were going to bring back Murder, She Wrote today, you wouldn't bring it back the same way it was done in the 80s and 90s. You would bring it back with a younger Jessica Fletcher, so she is not being compared to Angela Lansbury, is an impossible bar to meet.
Great.
Yeah, but tell me something. How old in your mind is she?
In my mind, she is perpetually between 62. She's about 64, 65. She's never going to become 70, but she can't be less than 60 to be realistic.
You know something? That reminds me of Miss Marple. I remember when I in my Murder à la Christie, I had to reread all the Christie books. I reread about 17 of them. And I realized that when they considered her an older woman, she was in her 60s, Miss Marple. So it's the same thing. As Jessica Fletcher, you know, as you said, you think of her as in her 60s. So, and she never ages.
Well, one of the good things now is that people, as they age, they're not losing their acting skills, because now there are series and there are things that they do to keep themselves alive. You know, at one point people would say, like, over 50, forget them. You know, nobody's interested, but that's not the case anymore. You know, like Tom Selleck, like in Blue Bloods. I mean, all of these are all back. Which means I think it's so much leeway for writers now to not have to just feel that they need to write younger characters. They can write older characters, and it can be interesting.
I agree with you, because sometimes people look at older people as if they can't do anything. And that becomes a stereotype, too. I'm finding even when I walk in, I'm not that old, walk into a room and go like, yeah. I think the most resentful question is when you walk in, like, what's your date of birth? I have no clue. It's none of your business. They make an older person feel as if they're senile and they can't do anything. So by bringing Jessica, or Miss, I love Miss Marple, and I have to tell you, John, before I did your review for the Jessica Fletcher books, I had to watch a few, too, to make sure that I got it straight and then didn't put it the way it is. So when you write, Marcia suggested something to me the other day, and I asked one of the New York Times authors did read my book and gave me some great feedback. Do you ever use italics to tell what the author, what the character says?
I do.
Somebody that's dead like you do. Like John has a character that's dead who I love. That too bad he's not alive. You have a character that do you use italics to say to make it easier? Because to me that would make it easier than using quotes.
I use it for thoughts.
That's what I do too.
Yeah,
that's what I do.
Yeah.
Thoughts. Yeah, I do.
I think you can overuse italics in my view. I use them too. I think we all do to a degree.
Yeah.
But it's if you want to set something off, like it's a flashback or something, then it can work. But I've read books and where I've found the italics confusing because at some point you're like, well, why is that in italic? I think they're good. I think it's just a matter of they need to be used correctly.
Fran, can I just ask you a question? What is it about quotes that you don't like? You don't like quotations?
No, it's not that I don't like quotations, and I can do them because I'm a reading and writing
specialist.
Yeah,
I know
that. They're just annoying. And, I get annoyed when my editor says, you put that in the wrong place. I said, that's why I'm paying you to fix the problem.
Yeah.
Don't call it a problem. I seriously tell Maxine, do me a favor, just fix my mistakes and then tell me what content I have to fix. So when I wrote this last one, Silent Voices, I did kill off a lot of people, some that I knew and some that I don't know and some that I made up. And I decided somebody told me to write a backstory to tell about them, the kind of person they are, before they got in trouble and they're dead. See, the person either did something wrong and they deserve to be there because I said so, or somebody put them there and I feel so bad. So what happens, like, John, or you have a character in a relationship. I'm waiting for Claire to meet somebody finally. Alan, you have Elizabeth, and I'm waiting for Laura to meet somebody. And Victoria Templeton, she doesn't need to meet any more people. She's got enough problems there with meeting guys. So when the characters are in a relationship and it doesn't work out, how do you create the conflict and dialogue, and how do you create the emotional upheavals? And do you ever just, like, give them somebody else, or does it work out? I mean, because I know Caitlin Strong, she's going to be with Court Wesley. Forget it. You can't do anything about that. They have to stay together. So how do you do – even they have conflict. How do you do that when they're in a relationship and use the dialogue so that you get angry at the author for not – making them happy.
Well, you asked about Claire, and you said Claire hadn't met anybody, and she meets actually a lot of men. She just never winds up,
I know. She's a Victoria Templeton kind of person.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of anger. I mean, in the new book plus the last one, she's with a guy who's sort of married, but and the bottom line is he goes back to his wife, and there's a lot of anger on her part. And, I guess I just draw on that from, not only relationships I know, but probably relationships I've been. Not too many people, break up with somebody without anger. And, it's never just, oh, that would be nice. Yes, we'll very go on our way. There's always passion. There's always anger. But the one thing that I do, and I do it just because as for a practical means, is I try and have, a friend she confides in. And Fran, you've read the Claire book. She has her friend Janet. And by doing that, Claire can kind of open up about her, insecurities and stuff to this friend, and then the friend can kind of give her advice. And that's a ploy I use to sort of get some of Claire's emotional feelings. And I can do that in dialogue rather than have Claire just thinking it in her head, because I just think it's a lot more interesting when she can talk about it with someone. And the friend can be critical, because Claire will say something like, oh, yeah, you know, I've got everything under control. And the friend will be like, you've never had anything under control. You know, it's like she basically points out all the flaws in the romances. So, but it's very, to me, it's very real life. Not too many people have romances where they live happily ever after and they never have a fight. You know, if you're with somebody, you generally have their issues.
Right.
And when you break up with somebody, there's always issues.
Yeah. Like, you know, sometimes I send my characters to psychiatrists, then they can talk to psychiatrists, you know, because, and then sometimes the truth comes out, or otherwise they just continue to keep lying to the psychiatrist, even though the psychiatrist knows they're lying, but they can't help themselves. So you have somebody that they talk to, you know.
Well, I think there's the benefit of dialogue again, because the main character can say something, and the best friend, the psychiatrist, the therapist, you know, whoever points out, no, that's not true. You know, you really feel this way, or you've done this before, and that's the, you know, that's one of the pluses of dialogue.
I agree with you. My mother taught me that if somebody doesn't want to go out with you and you break up, who cares? Don't go. Don't even worry about it. Just move right on to the next. And she said, and my grandmother was saying, but the road traveled, it's trampled, so don't go back over it. So what happens when you add? Serious? I know. I mean.
Well, like, mine was said it another way. You go back the same way you came, so you make sure it's okay. I'm not going to say exact words she said, but, you know, they all grandmothers, they used to have
family. Yeah,
And we remember that, which is a good thing, which is also good when you have, like, you can add a grandparent. Because people seem to like grandparents and like dogs or whatever. They like them in books. You know, I know
you put them in the
people
same
like
sentence.
Dogs because people do talk to dogs. I mean, you know, whoever has dogs, you find yourself talking to them. And I had one where I said before that I had a dog. One of the dogs talks to me in my book, so she's talking to the characters. It's Never Too Late for Love, which I didn't have when I wrote the screenplay, but I added when I wrote the book because I thought it. And they just feels like it feels right to me that sometimes what you want your dog to talk back to you. You want someone to answer you. You know, if you're not talking, you know, to anybody at home, you might want somebody. If, like, say, your husband or wife doesn't listen, that they don't listen, you have a dog.
No, I had a bird. That was it. And he sang to me while I played the piano. So let's just say, I was really good. What happens when you add a third party in a relationship and things get out of hand? So how do you do the dialogue? Let's say, you know, somebody dares to flirt with Court, or goes after Elizabeth. You have to kill the person off. Forget that. So what do you do when there's a third person in a relationship? How do you handle it? And does each speaker get their own paragraph? So that people understand. Sometimes I go crazy when somebody writes dialogue and all of a sudden in the middle of the paragraph they flash back to 20 years from this Wednesday. That drives me crazy. Then I have to figure
I think you have to use the names more often if you're introducing more than two people. You can't just say he and she, so you better be using their names more frequently.
Yeah.
And you can always kill them off, my feeling. I kind of have a situation like that in the book I'm writing, and the person is murdered. Yeah, but not by, you know, well, anyway, it's, yeah. So I kill the person off, you know, the interloper. See, something could do, But meanwhile, there are dialogues. But you're right. You have to use the names more often. So just make it clear to
the
reader.
In the middle of a paragraph, they're talking about something that happened in the present. And then two sentences later, I go, like, wait a minute. What? And that's when I give them not a lot of stars. That's when I say, like, I'm not sure if I want to read this anymore. And then they'll say, you know, can you do something? And I go, well, I have to make it sound better than it really is. Because it's hard as a reviewer,
it's
diplomatic.
Interesting,
I never write
Fran,
bad
because
things.
What we've moved on to now highlights something. First off, multiple person conversations are much harder to write because by nature you're exchanging information. People are telling the reader what they know or what they've learned. They can be used as info dumps, is what my editor will call them occasionally. When you think of the great masters of the great modern masters of crime dialogue, thriller dialogue, when you think about Elmore Leonard, when you think about George Higgins, when you think about George Pelicanos, almost every scene they write, and I've never thought about this before, as opposed to a thriller, they're more mysteries, they're more crime. Almost every scene is just two people.
Yeah.
But in a thriller, because you need to get more information out to the reader. And the worst way to get information to the reader is to give it to them in a paragraph that often gets skipped, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
It's much more effective to give information in dialogue. But in doing that, because you've essentially created exposition with quotation marks, you need to find a way to make it punchy. You need to find a way. Again, the conflict is there. The characters aren't always agreeing with each other. Maybe there's one who says, prove it to me. If you don't prove, I'm giving you 5 minutes. Prove to me that this guy is the killer. Prove to me we're all in danger. We're all going to die. And then there is, you've defined the scene where information is being dumped to the reader in terms of conflict because you put a clock on it. Because you don't want to do it in a way that makes the reader think that they're being spoon-fed information. You want them to be learning it organically. Yeah. You want it to be unfolding. And you don't – Elmore Leonard believed that you never said anything but said. None of this – he related, he expanded, he smiled, he shrugged. Yeah. Just leave it alone. Let it stand on its own. And Leonard also said that the mark of great dialogue is not needing any he said, she says, because you can tell by the cadence who is speaking.
Right.
That's
right.
A difficult bar.
Yeah.
But you can also, instead of saying the names, because it's 100% right, when you're dealing in a multiple-party conversation, you need to say the names, but you don't have to do it blank said. You could say he twirled his thumbs, he leaned forward, he leaned back.
Yeah.
He stuck a pencil in his ear too deeply and cried out in pain. Blood. And the important thing here is when you, and I'm going to quote James Lee Burke, who said, when writing a scene, always know where the light is coming from. We think about description when we're writing an action sequence or exposition. We don't always think of description when we're writing dialogue, but it's just as important in a scene of dialogue to know where the light is coming from as it is in a scene of action. So in other words, it's just as important to how you set the scene where your characters are as what your characters are saying.
Yes, I agree. Yes.
I agree.
I'd like to bring up a problem that, one specific that I have that probably the rest of you don't because of the type of character I write, which is a media person. Most of my dialogue in the Claire Carlson books are one-on-one because they're just those kind of – it's just that kind of a book, that kind of character. I have the problem of news meetings. So she's the news director of a station. So the way that information comes out, the information dump, as John said, a lot is from these news meetings. So like homeless woman is killed and all these people are saying, oh, we don't care about that story. And then somebody says, well, why don't we look into it? And so you may have like 10 people in the room, a half dozen speaking. You don't want to give everybody names because they're not that big of characters. So if you throw out names, that just gets even more complicated.
Yeah.
So you get into this tricky area where, I'll do one editor said or another reporter, did that. But that's where, to me, that is the hardest problem I have. And there may be only like about three or four maybe instances in my book where we have that news meeting. But it's the question of how do I get the information out from the news meeting, but how do I also make clear? I mean, Claire speaking is always pretty clear. People know what Claire sounds like. But you have other people in the room, and how do you identify them? And that can be a little tricky.
Well, let me ask you something. Isn't it possible for you, after you do you introduce some dialogue, and then you just have a few sentences, narrative sentences, just saying, what was discussed, and then have someone else make a comment, sort of tie it up in a sentence.
Yeah, that's certainly one way. But again, as we've, as this is a panel about dialogue, and I think a lot of us have said, and I'm one of them, that I really like using dialogue to get the information across as opposed to the narrative. So, yes, there are instances where you can do that. But in the newsroom meeting, it's a real back and forth. So I tend to use the narrative more sparingly in that case. And, you know, I think I'm able to pull it off, but you just have to be – You have to be careful that you're not another editor, or give somebody a name. You could say someone said or something, because a person may be only saying one line, but it's a line you want to get that point across.
Do they ever have in a newsroom where they summarize, or somebody takes notes, or somebody gives everybody what was discussed? I mean, I'm really good at that. That's my thing. You know, Marcia knows I can summarize anything. But before I forget, Wednesday at 12 o'clock, this is shocks me. I keep talking to myself because I can't believe it. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child will talk about Verses for the Dead. Yeah, live at 12 o'clock on my show.
Okay.
How about that?
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
I read that book and interviewed them for a magazine. That's a terrific book.
It is. It's excellent, and I hope my questions are excellent too, because I separated them for each author, and I got the confirmation just 5 minutes ago. On the 18th, Jessica Barry from England, Free Fall. That's a phenomenal book. Bruno Scoppi's story, Crystal King, on the 21st. Jean DeRusha is going to be here again for Dark Paradise, we hope, the 26th. This is what happens when Fran sees somebody on Facebook and says, would you like an interview? David Putnam. Yep. David Putnam, The Reckless. Yeah. And what better way to finish February but with Herbie Pilato, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and a tribute to her life. I am so pumped. Yes, and I have 6 books that I have to read, including John's, including Lee Goldberg, who's coming on March 21st at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I have
well,
to
there you go. Talk
books.
About a newsroom that made newsroom popularity when she did her show.
Yes, they did. I know. So one long question here. I'm doing a panel show on April 3rd with Larry Thompson, Bruce Coffin, Jerry Farrow, and Charles Salzberg, and this time we're going to talk about setting, and my questions are really over the top, they told me. How does setting sometimes add to the dialogue when the characters have to place themselves in different situations that they've never been? How do they deal with that? That's one of my, just came up. I know, it's on the paper. It's
here
really
we go.
There.
All
seriously.
The people with dialogue, we're all just sitting here going like, well.
I know John has different settings and different characters in different dialogue, different time periods. Alan does too. So I just started Strong to Steel. And seriously, how does Caitlin deal with her life when she's younger as opposed to when she gets older in the different scenes?
Oh, that's different.
And
yeah.
I have no problem understanding that. Okay.
Well, you're talking about Strong
to Steel.
I think the great point you're making is what I started to get at before about always know where the light is coming from, also in a scene of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about setting the scene. You're talking about not just where they're what they're saying, but where is it? But how do you? The key thing is to bring the setting to life. What you don't want to have is two talking heads sitting across a table from each other. Just even if there's conflict, the scene could be very dull.
Yeah.
So it's a lot better. And here's how you do it, Fran. Here's how you do it. Here's one way to do it, not the only way. If you have two characters in a restaurant and one of them is facing another table where something is going on that is affecting them. Maybe they think the person at that other table has come into that restaurant to kill the person they're talking to. Maybe they're wondering if that person at the other table is the killer who they've been afraid is after them. So what you have is, and this is the phrase, we talked about conflict before, you add external conflict to an interior scene of dialogue where two characters are talking, but there is an element beyond them which is affecting one of the people at the table. Now, here is a key thing. You can't have two characters having the same thing happening because now you have two different points of view for the scene. Even in a scene of dialogue, There should be a viewpoint. There should be a dominant viewpoint. There should be one person who's driving the action in that the scene unfolds from his or her viewpoint, not from both their viewpoints. So that seems like I'm splitting hairs, but it's important because it brings the scene of it brings the dialogue to life because you've set the scene amidst an, or something of other things that are going on around them. It's not just to and if you want to put them alone and have them have a conversation, put them in a roller coaster. Put them in a merry-go-round. Put them in a fun house. So you have external things happening which are not necessarily driving the action, which is being driven by the dialogue, but they are reflecting and enhancing the action, which is the dialogue.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So what? I have two more questions. We have about 5 minutes. Who cares? I can go over the time. When creating dialogue between main characters, I'm finding that the police or dealing with the villains or dealing with law enforcement, they don't always like the main character. We know that. Don't we, John, Caitlin, whatever. So what happens when the main character has to deal with the police? How do they manage to get the correct words and tone and the mood to make it realistic to me who's reading the book?
Well, I have my character is friendly with the police person, the lieutenant, and but I got a kick speech. I was thinking of dialogue where he leaves her and he tells her, now I don't want you getting involved in this murder. And then the ghost appears as soon as he leaves and she says, of course you're going to get involved. So it's a conflict. And it's not where he hates her or he's very fond of her. You know, he's an older person and he's a very good friend of her uncle and her boyfriend. And so she has to be very careful because, you know, it's not one of these simplistic relationships because there is this conflict between the amateur sleuth and the police.
I think it goes back to the conflict issue.
Yeah, go on.
I think it goes back to the conflict issue that, you know, we talked about, that if you have a lot of dialogue without a lot of conflict, it's not going to be very interesting. Mm-hmm. So in most cases, a reporter, which is my character, it's not going to walk into a police officer and it's going to be like, we'd really like your help on this case, and, oh, let's work together. I mean, it's not like that. It's like, keep your nose out. It's not your job. You know, there's going to be a adversary relationship. Which makes it interesting. And the one just final thought on that, because I was thinking about that as the question came up, I think the best way you can do this, the scenario I'm thinking of right now is something like the Rockford Files, which is one of the great, mysteries of all time, where you have cops that don't get along with them, but you do. So, like, he's got Dennis, who's his friend on the force. And Dennis gets exasperated with Rockford, but he's still his friend. But then all the other cops hate Rockford, you know, including the commanding officer. And I think that's a nice balance because you've got one person who he can talk to, but, you know, that person can turn on him too. But the others, like, he's got to work against them. And when you're writing a book, I just think that conflict makes the dialogue and the book so much more interesting.
Yeah,
and I think sometimes
you
when you're writing,
the FBI, don't you?
Yeah,
don't you have the FBI and Alan with Craig?
Sure,
gets in
absolutely.
Trouble all over the place.
Yep. And you have to interact the private person with the official government agency. It's a little bit tricky.
Yeah.
But you got to make them work together. Absolutely, it's key. I mean, it really is. And it's the comes down to the relationships between.
I think
so,
no, because I think, Fran, sometimes you just have to let yourself go and just write the book. I mean, it sounds like it's you can't
point.
Because if I sat here and thought about setting and dialogue and everything when I'm writing, I wouldn't write anything because it would be all too confusing.
Yeah,
you know, because I think get back to the beginning is like your characters take you where they need to go.
I agree. I think at this point our minds just work. They do everything intuitively. We know when to use dialogue, when a little bit of narrative is needed to cut down on the unnecessary dialogue if it's not really leading any place. And I think we just do everything intuitively at this point.
But then when the editor says, why did you put that in? You go like, oh, well, you know, then you know, you go like, then you, that's why you have an editor, because if you go too far or don't put enough in, the editor will help you out there and say, like, this is, we don't understand this, and why did you do this? You know, as much as we all think when we give a book to an editor it's going to be perfect, we know what happens. It's not. We think it's going to be, you know, we haven't made that many grammar, you know, mistakes, or we haven't done that, but a lot of times we do. So that's why we get help that way, but they can't do our story for us. So you just have to get your story out too, because otherwise you'll just sit there and be afraid to write anything.
You have some editors that say to you, you know, you should rewrite this, or they say to you, well, I don't like that scene. And I don't know, when you're traditional publishers, I guess you have to listen. When you're independent, I guess you don't. And why did you write that? Could you fix it? I go, like, I can fix it if I knew what you meant to fix it.
You have to trust your editor. You have to trust your editor that they know how you write.
Yeah.
That would be fun with what we're talking about. I've been watching the third season of True Detective.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, all the things we're talking about are encapsulated by that series, even though it's a different form of media, a different medium. When you look at how conflict is used, because conflict is used to drive story through dialogue, how setting is used, and what makes it special is that there are three timelines. So you see the same characters at three different ages. They're not the same people anymore in any of those time frames, in any of those. And it's a brilliant exercise in what conflict-riddled, tension-riddled crime drama is all about. It's an absolutely brilliant series.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of like an older time. The first two are good, and I want to see the third one. I just haven't had a chance yet. But you're right. That's written that way.
I'm going to have to watch it, because I just write from the point of view of somebody dead that did something wrong. And it makes it, get into their head. But anyway, so where can we learn all about your latest releases to come and more about you and your work? And this is fun, let me tell you. So, Marilyn, I have you down for September 16th when the book comes out. And
I think it's coming out the 11th. Oh, yeah. My new book is coming out September 11th, and it's called Buried in the Stacks. I have nothing to do with the titles, but there's an element of homeless.
One.
Yeah, thanks. The homeless people who come to the library, and a group of people are setting up a haven house for them, and there's some shenanigans about that, and of course a few murders. So that will be out in September, on September 10th, I think, or 11th. And
Alan Topol, my next book, The Washington Operator, is going to come out late summer, early fall. Kelly Cameron's going to be in this, following her up, and it's a good Washington lobbyist power play kind of novel. Thanks for having me today. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to, and I can't wait to read that. You got to let me know when you want the interview, because
Absolutely. My
show's booked till the end of. My show's booked to the end of forever. John,
okay.
When am I getting the murder one? Because I have you down for April 23rd for the other one.
I like to keep you in suspense, so.
I know. It came in the mail. I go, like, huh? That's what happened.
I don't know
with
why
the
I didn't.
Goldberg's
I didn't
book.
Put
I
both.
Went, huh?
In the, didn't I send you both in the same? Oh, so, no, you got that from. Did I
no,
send that to you?
No, there was
no,
only
okay.
only one in.
Now I got
to
pay
Harper
the postage
Collins
again.
Sent me two.
Fran, I wish I could read as fast as you. I wish I could read as fast as you. That's what I wish.
You
know,
James Capando's coming out with one on Tuesday. That's fantastic. It took me 2 hours. I read it the other day. Absolutely. So when is Murder in Red coming out, and when is everything else? Don't even ask.
Murder in Red comes out May 28th. It's my third effort in the Murder, She Wrote series. And I think I'm starting to figure Jessica out. So hopefully I'm doing, you know, it's a constant race to be better.
Oh, forget it. You guys can't get anybody. You're great. And, Dick, I'm excited because on May 7th we're going to talk about Below the Fold. And where can we find out more about – I'm so excited because I found his first book. His publicist sent it to me, yesterday's news, and it was staring at me in my pile. And I go, like, read it.
Well, that one obviously is still available if you want to start with that one, because that's the first in the series. Then second, that Below the Fold, will be, I mean, you can read them separately, but obviously it's good to read the first one first. Below the Fold will be out May 7th. I think actually it's coming out the day that I'll be on the show with you, May 7th. So we'll have something to talk about. And Marcia, I'm going to be talking to you.
Yes, you're going to come on my show. And you know who's joining us? Fran, because then we can, then Fran can talk to Fran is joining us.
That's terrific. We'll be,
That's what she said. So, I'm making an exception because Fran doesn't do Friday, but just for you guys, I'm doing a Friday.
I picked Friday. I don't, you know, with me, I just kind of pick. You know, I have my shows on Tuesday, but I just add on shows a lot. So I think, because Fran,
tell
I think,
about
we're going to let Fran talk. This, Fran.
That's scary. Maybe by that time, silent voices. But I have to tell you that MJ Magazine, edition 12, came out 2 weeks ago, and a lot of people are buying it. They think it's great. It's writers from all over the world, young writers that did book reviews, believe it or not. My nephew Jake wrote an article on electronics in the classroom, and I think Alan read it, and some other people read it, and it's really good. And I was very proud of it. So I'm looking for more articles for MJ 13 or 14 for April. If you have any gripes, you want to write about anything, I don't care. I'm doing a health issue too, so I'm going to put some stuff about autism and things like that. And John, where can we find out? Where can we find out about all your thousands of books?
Well, there's johnlandbooks.com. I haven't done a very good job of staying up with it. I tell people Google me. Go to Amazon. Go to Barnes and Noble. You know, that's usually the way you get more objective stuff. Ignore the Amazon reviews of my take on Jessica Fletcher. I've upset too many people by making her
too bad.
Taking her into the 21st century, but that's a topic for another show.
Well, she didn't upset me. And Marcia, where can we find out about all your hot and steamy on your kids' books?
Well, I'm doing a new Virginia Templeton book as soon as Virginia gets over her husband faking his own death. Yeah, I think so. And on my show is Marcia Casper Cook, and I have a show. And actually, I'm on a guest tomorrow on Red River, where I started doing my radio shows, You Too, Fran, with Kieran Vaughn tomorrow. This is my time to talk, I guess. Usually, I like to hear everybody else talk. But, this will be fun. This was very fun today. Thank you for having me, and I love listening to everybody. And when I'm done with the show, I realize I'm probably should be doing more screenwriting, because when I hear what I said, I'm always talking in the scenes. It's like therapy.
Well,
I'm
going to email everybody the thing. Marilyn, where can we find out about you and all your books? Want to make sure I got that.
Well, on my website, www.marilynlevinson.com, and my Amazon page, Marilyn Levinson. And I do have a pseudonym, Allison Brooke, but everyone knows it's me. So I have everything under one place.
As long as I know it's you.
I mean, all my readers know, so it doesn't matter.
Alan dropped off, but everybody's got to read his Craig Page series. It's fantastic. The Russian Resurgence was phenomenal. And his Washington Lawyer series is great. And I want to thank everybody.
Thank you.
And thank you, Fran, for having me.
You're welcome. I got a weather alert that there's going to be weather in our area, so don't be surprised if the power goes out tomorrow, because it's going to snow. And hopefully we won't have to worry about too much ice. But thank you so very much.
Thank
you. Whenever you want to surprise me, I'll add another book to my pile of 20 on my chair. I should take a picture and put it on my Facebook. Everybody have a great day. It's beautiful outside, and bye.
Right.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye, friends. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Bye.